Welcome to Caldwell University Conversations. I'm Colette Liddy, Director of News and Media Relations. November is National Diabetes Awareness Month, aimed at focusing on the impact of the disease on millions of Americans. In New Jersey, there are reportedly 862,000 residents with the condition. Today, we are going to talk about prevention, symptoms, managing, and living with diabetes with Dr. Donna Natural, Assistant Professor in Caldwell's School of Nursing and Public Health. She is also an adult nurse practitioner and a certified diabetes educator. So great to have you here. And those statistics are quite interesting. I'm also looking here at the national statistics. It says 30.3 million people have diabetes. So what do you have to say about the prevalence?
So over the years, more people have been diagnosed with diabetes because of some changes that were made with the diagnosis in diabetes back in 1997. Prior to 97, people just needed to have blood sugars that were elevated above 140. In 1997, the American Diabetes Association, along with the American Academy of Clinical Endocrinologists, decreased those numbers to be a blood sugar greater than 126 on two separate occasions is all that somebody needs to be diagnosed with diabetes. So they've lowered the ranges. Or one random blood sugar over 200 at any point during the day is enough for a patient to be diagnosed with diabetes.
Interesting. Why do you think New Jersey has this amount that's above the national? You have statistics there. What is the national average?
Right. So the national average is about 10% of the population has diabetes. In New Jersey, we are in epidemic proportions, and we have about 11.3% of the adult population in New Jersey has diabetes. It's usually type 2 diabetes, which is the more common type of the disease. And it probably has to do with we are also a very densely populated state. So we have many more individuals living here in our small state. Probably risk factors, family history. There's a few different risk factors. Sedentary lifestyles, probably economics, access to fast foods, which may, you know, increase somebody's risk if they have a family history of type 2 diabetes in their history.
So the difference between type 1 and type 2 diabetes.
Okay. There are actually two distinct disease processes. Type 1 diabetes occurs in children or younger adults, and what happens is their pancreas ceases to work. So they're not producing the beta cells, which are needed to balance out the carbohydrates. Our body naturally produces glucose in the beta cells of the pancreas. And somebody who has type 1 diabetes stops producing those beta cells and stops producing insulin. So they're requiring insulin injections every day to replace the insulin that their body's not making. Fortunately, only about 5 to 10% of the people who have diabetes have type 1 diabetes. The much more common type is type 2. Diabetes where the person is producing insulin. At times, they may even be producing too much insulin for their body's needs, hypersecreting insulin. Then they could be developing insulin resistance, which can result in inadequate utilization of the insulin their body's producing, not allowing the sugar to get into the cells to nourish it, but keeping the sugar from the foods into the bloodstream so the person results with elevated blood sugar.
Now, what are some of the prevention steps that a person can take to prevent type 2?
So with type 2 diabetes, first of all, some of the risk factors that people can have are having a family history. So knowing, you know, grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins, if there's a strong family history there, then your chances of developing type 2 diabetes can be increased. Age, there's not much we can do about age, but being over the age of 45 can increase a person's risk for developing type 2 diabetes. A history of gestational diabetes, so a woman who had gestational diabetes during pregnancy or who had a baby who weighed 9 pounds could mean that she had undiagnosed gestational diabetes, or maybe she had gestational diabetes. So that's another sign that would be a potential risk factor. A patient who has hypertension or elevated lipids, high cholesterol, can also be at risk for developing type 2 diabetes. People who are inactive, sedentary lifestyle, obesity, poor diet, many of these factors together can put a patient at risk for developing type 2 diabetes.
Now, you are a certified diabetes educator. Mm-hmm. And what is that? How do you help a person who has diabetes?
Yeah. So I am also a nurse practitioner. So I'm an adult mm-hmm. nurse practitioner. So I can actually manage diabetes from the medical perspective as well. And I am a certified diabetes educator, and I've gone through extensive training and taking a national certification exam many, many years ago that prepares you to be able to teach patients to manage their diabetes, self-care management, according to the American Diabetes Association standards of care, which is very comprehensive self-management education that we would teach a patient.
And when did you start doing this?
A long time ago. I've been a nurse practitioner since 1994 and a diabetes educator since 1999.
And you did some work with veterans.
I did. So when I was in my master's program back in the early 1990s, I was fortunate enough to be placed at the VA healthcare system in East Orange, actually in the diabetes clinic. So I was working closely with a diabetes nurse practitioner, and it was really during that role that I became interested in diabetes management as well as diabetes education. It was a unique program at that point because the NPs, the nurse practitioners, were seeing patients in the morning in the clinic, and then in every afternoon we ran a diabetes self-management support education and
very
support
good.
Program, which was very comprehensive. So that was kind of my first introduction into it.
So that got you mm-hmm. into the field. Interesting.
It did.
So we talk a little bit about the signs and symptoms. Mm-hmm. And can a person be in denial for a while? And what would be some symptoms where he or she just needed to be checked out or screened?
Right. So the signs and symptoms of diabetes can be very vague. So I don't know if they're in denial or if they may not notice them. But the signs of actually for type 1 and type 2 diabetes are actually very similar. The difference between the two is that the signs for type 1 diabetes can occur very quickly. The signs include increased thirst, increased urination, increased appetite. There's medical terms that go along with those as well, the three Ps, polyuria, polyphagia, and polydipsia. And with somebody who has type 1 diabetes, it's an acute onset. The child, I'm going to say child because that's usually what it is, almost goes into a temporary starvation mode. They lose a lot of weight. They can lose up to 10% of their body weight pretty rapidly, and they usually end up in the hospital or in the intensive care unit in something known as diabetic ketoacidosis. That's in a child with type 1 diabetes. An adult with type 2 diabetes can also present with increased thirst, increased urination, maybe blurred vision, dry, itchy skin, nocturia, which is waking up frequently at night to have to go to the bathroom, not so much the weight loss because they're not going into the ketoacidosis that somebody who type 1 would have. But usually the symptoms for type 2 diabetes can be missed, especially if you have an adult who's over the age of 45. Because even, I'll give you the example of a male, if they're having increased thirst, increased urination, waking up frequently at night to urinate, they may not notice it because of other conditions that can also be occurring in that population, such as prostate disorders, having a salty diet, feeling like they need to drink because they haven't had any water all day long, so then they're drinking later at night with fluids to try to maintain hydration, waking up frequently to go to the bathroom, kind of washing away the symptoms to the salty meal that they had, compensating by having the additional fluids because the meals were so salty, and just kind of missing the symptoms. So the best way to identify if somebody does have diabetes is really to get screened or to have blood sugars checked.
And where do you get screened?
You can get screened with your doctor's office with routine labs. As I mentioned earlier, the way that diabetes is diagnosed, and this is for both type 1 and type 2, is to have two fasting blood sugars greater than 126. 126 isn't very high. When we think about a normal fasting glucose of being 70 to maybe 99, and these ranges can differ based on the reference ranges of the labs. But still, you're not that much higher than normal. If we're looking at normal being slightly under 100, and then you've got two fastings greater than 126, and you've got a diagnosis of diabetes for your life. Or you could have a postprandial, which means a blood sugar 2 hours after you've eaten, greater than 140. Okay, normally people can have blood sugars 2 hours after they eat up to 140, but if it's up above 140, that would be a trigger that we need to, that the patient's having difficulty metabolizing the carbohydrates that they've eaten. So that would be a sign that maybe we need to monitor this patient. There's another blood test that can be done, which is called the hemoglobin A1C, which is also called glycosylated hemoglobin. And that blood test is actually now can be used as a screening. It shows how much glucose the red blood cells were exposed to during their lifespan. So our red blood cells in our body can live for about 90 to 120 days. So as these cells are recycling, you can tell, you know, what was the patient's average blood glucose. Normal for somebody without diabetes is under 5.4. When somebody has a hemoglobin A1C between 5.7 to 6.4, they have something called prediabetes. Mm-hmm. So prediabetes can actually be a sign that somebody's at risk for developing diabetes, and maybe if they're diagnosed with prediabetes, that's when they need to, you know, go for some education, start to, you know, meet with a dietitian to learn about, you know, what kind of dietary changes can be done, increase exercise, walking, stress management, lifestyle changes that can help to decrease the blood sugar level.
So that it leads me to ask you, when someone is diagnosed, mm-hmm. Where can he or she get help from a certified diabetes educator? Where do you set up your plan for how you're going to live your life?
Right? Okay. Yep. So actually, when a person's diagnosed with diabetes, their hemoglobin A1C is 6.5 or greater. And what would usually happen is the doctor would first start to talk to the patient about the lifestyle choices, probably refer them to a diabetes educator or a diabetes center, which many of the local hospitals do have. And then the patient can meet with both a nurse, who's a diabetes educator, as well as a dietitian, because we work collaboratively with both focusing on different areas of specialty. Usually somebody with prediabetes is gonna work primarily with the dietitian, because we know that it's gonna be diet and lifestyle modifications that they need. Somebody who has full-blown type 2 diabetes is going to probably require a comprehensive diabetes self-management education training, which can be about 10 hours of training.
Interesting.
Which is comprehensive, yeah.
Interesting. I'm looking at something, you're talking about lifestyle changes, mm-hmm. and I'm looking at something here that says research has also shown that drinking sugary drinks is linked to type 2 diabetes, mm-hmm. and this is from the American Diabetes Association. But for some people, that's difficult to just drink water. What is your recommendation?
Right. Yeah, and the reason is when a person has diabetes, or prediabetes, what we need to do is we need to manage the carbohydrate load that patients are consuming. So if we're going to, I'm just going to say, like, as a general rule, if like a female was going to have 45 grams of carbohydrates at a meal, that could consist of a piece of fruit for 15 and maybe a sandwich for another 30, 15 grams for each slice of bread, and then whatever you put in between, whether it's turkey or tuna or whatever, there's usually no carbs. So that would be 45 grams. We'll use that as an example and we'll compare it to a can of regular Coke. A can of regular Coke has 12 ounces of soda in it. Each 4 ounces consists of 15 grams of carbohydrates. So that one can of Coke is going to be equal to the meal that I just gave the example of before, the sandwich and the piece of fruit. Mm. So the problem is the Coke doesn't include any fats or any proteins. So that 45 grams of carbohydrates is just going to increase the blood sugar very, very rapidly and not provide the patient with any nutrients. You know, and really it's calories that are empty with a lot of carbohydrates. So for somebody who has diabetes, that consistency of, you know, high sugary liquid is just going to jump the blood sugars up and they're going to feel terrible. They're going to feel tired.
So their alternative is they could put some fruit in their water or something like that.
Absolutely. Yeah, so because we all know that the diet sodas aren't much better, right? Because of all the other issues. So water is a great option. Some people don't like the taste of water. So what we sometimes recommend is just putting a little bit of lemon in your water. The other thing I've said to some patients is actually the diet cranberry juice, it's 5 calories. So if you look at that in the supermarket and then you could put a splash of cranberry in your water, it might add a nice little flavor. Or many people are using the fruit infused waters as well. You know, because you want to try to increase that water consumption so that you stay hydrated.
Very good. Well, final question. Mm-hmm. You're teaching the next generation of nurses and public health professionals. So what are you teaching them about diabetes?
Yeah. So actually, since this is Diabetes Month, it actually just worked out this way that we did diabetes last week in the class. I teach here at Caldwell University pathophysiology and pharmacology to the nursing students. So in the fall, I teach pathophysiology, and in the spring, we do pharmacology. So I just went through including all of the pathophysiology associated with diabetes, differentiating between the patho between type 1 diabetes, the causes, and type 2, and really trying to get them to recognize that they're two distinct disease processes. We talked about all of the different complications that can occur in patients if they have uncontrolled diabetes for an extended period of time, because diabetes is a disease which really affects the whole person from the eyes down to the toes. That's exactly what I tell them and what I tell all of my patients too. So if somebody does have diabetes, what they're going to need to do is really learn how to manage their care. And I try to explain this to the students because they're going to be out there with all of their patients, and we know that about 11% of the population has diabetes, so they're going to come across many patients with diabetes during their career.
Definitely. Yeah. Throughout their career.
Absolutely.
Well, I want to thank you very much. We could keep on talking here. This has been very valuable information. Our guest has been Dr. Donna Natural. My thanks to our student, Drew Timothy, for his production assistance. I'm Colette Liddy. Be sure and join us next time for Caldwell University Conversations.